Good evening, everybody. I'm Allison Civic, Executive Director of the Gila Conservation Coalition. I'm really excited to have Jack Leffler and his friends, his guests, Thinking Like a Watershed. This panel has been many years in coming, and I'm very pleased that we made it work this year. So we...
Yes.
Wow.
So with that, I would like to once again introduce Jack Leffler and Thinking Like a Watershed. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you so much, Allison. Thank you. And would like very much to thank all of you for coming this evening. We've all been looking forward to this enormously. On my immediate left is my old pal, Enrique Navarrete, who knows all sorts of things about acequias. And a little further to the left of me is, good old Steve Harris. Steve Harris is the head of Far Flung Adventures and also the head of the Rio Grande Restoration. And I'm very, very sorry to have to say that our fourth member, Rena Swensel, is very ill in bed as we speak. And she called me Wednesday morning in tears and said, I just am not well. And those of us who are over 70 can commiserate. But we will have a little bit of Rena with us later on. I wanted to say that this whole notion of thinking like a watershed has actually been batting around for many, many years. Then about 20-some years ago, I've forgotten exactly when, maybe around 1990, my dear friend Bill DeBuys, who's a writer, maybe you know of him, William DeBuys, a very important book of his is A Great Aridness, where Bill gets deeply into talking about the whole reality of global warming and climate instability. He wrote another book called Seeing Things Whole, The Essential John Wesley Powell. And in the frontispiece of that book is a map that appears in the front of the 11th annual report from the USGS to the Department of the Interior. That map was done back in 1888 through 90, and it's attributable to John Wesley Powell himself. So we'll start our program very briefly. I'm going to play an excerpt from the many miles of interviews that I've conducted with Bill DeBuys, and he will talk about this map.
John Wesley Powell. Here we see his map of the major watersheds of the so-called arid lands, along with their sub-watersheds in different shadings. And he proposed that the governance of the West be organized watershed by watershed. And if you look closely at this, you can see how completely he ignored state boundaries, which is a wonderful, wonderful relief from the usual division of the landscape of the West. This was the first true bioregional plan. He believed each of these units should be politically independent, and that the land within it, the irrigable land, would be owned individually by families. But the grazing land and the timberland would be managed communally by the whole watershed. But the fee, the underlying ownership interest, would remain with the sovereign, the federal government, which is to say that the watershed communities, commonwealths, could never sell off the commons. It would have to remain commons. Now, I don't know whether in this he was drawing on the model of the Spanish and Mexican land grants here, but under Spanish and Mexican law, that's exactly how those lands were set up, that in a sense the sovereign retained the fee.
I think that that's a pretty important concept, and it's really too bad that John Wesley Powell wasn't successful in getting Congress to go for that whole idea. But he was faked out by entrepreneurs who were more interested in turning habitat into money. I'm sure this is a concept that is available to just about everybody in this room. And he was also facing a bureaucracy of such magnitude that he couldn't overcome it. Now, I'm hoping that that is not the case in this room, that we can overcome any kind of a bureaucracy that does not maintain land as a sacred entity rather than as something to turn into money. So I'm going to turn over a microphone to Enrique Lamadrid, who will open our program with a short presentation. Each of us is going to do a short presentation this evening, and then we'll open it up for questions and issues to address and things like that. But this is my good friend, Enrique Lamadrid.
Thanks, Jack, and thanks so much to all of you for joining us this evening. It was so great going down to the river and splashing my face this morning. It's part of all of this. And I'm really happy to share some news from my own watersheds, I guess you could say. I was thinking, you know, what could I possibly throw onto this wagon? You all have done such an amazing job. There's been so many amazing leaders in this struggle since 1984, defeating two dams and a diversion, and these struggles just keep on keeping on. They're just endless, and that's what it takes. There is never any closure. All of this stuff is in continuous negotiation until we get what we want, until we get what's right. And so I commend you all for this heroism. It's really the best word for it. So my presentation tonight is on dividing the waters, dreams and nightmares, traditional versus industrial Trans Mountain water diversions in New Mexico. And there is something so deep about bringing water to a dry spot. If you have water over here and a dry spot over there, it is a deep human motivation to connect those two areas. And so maybe this is why our corporate and governmental enemies, really, at this point, are so entrenched. They're so entrenched. There's something that runs really, really deep here. So let's explore it. Let's leave our watershed for a minute. But before doing so, there's something to acknowledge. Every presentation that I make, I acknowledge those who have come before us and really ask their permission for even including them in our conversation. And these are the people of the Gila, the Chihene Nde, Warm Springs, Gileño, Mimbreño, Chiricahua, Apaches. They're all fluid between those different groups. And you know, we really need to start talking about Victorio. We really need to start acknowledging him. They finally did in Chihuahua, in Victor's movie. That plaza, that new plaza in Chihuahua, includes an equestrian statue of Victorio. I never thought it would happen in Mexico. He was such a terrific leader, as was Cochise, as was Nané on the right, who, after Victorio's death, it was a war of desperation at that point. These guys were amazing warriors, but the three on the right essentially sacrificed themselves for the good of their people. And it's not up to me to decide, but every time I see stuff like, Jerónimo was born in the headwaters of the Gila, well, you really need to check in with your Apache friends, because Jerónimo may be the reason that there's no Apache reservation around the Gila. He's certainly the reason that there's no Apache reservation in Turkey Creek Canyon, which is a huge area north of San Carlos and I guess east of White Mountain Apaches. And you can understand his rage, and you can understand, you know, the Mexican cavalry killed his family right in front of his eyes. And so he was bent on just vengeance for the rest of his life. And we can understand that as fellow humans. But he let those interests overtake his what should come first in all of our minds. If we want to be exceptional human beings, then it comes a time when we sacrifice ourselves for our people. And that's what the three guys did on the right. So, you know, check in with the Nde people who are around here, the Fort Sill, you know, there's a whole group of Apaches de Paz over in Erie and Derry when they were conducting these wars and trying to get them to like give it up and just settle down. And a whole group of them did. And they've been farmers, productive farmers ever since. And they've had a low profile. They're the red paint people. They're the people that should have had the Warm Springs reservation up from TRC. So my lecture is not about them, but it's acknowledging them, and it's encouraging you to talk to your Ndé Apache neighbors to get this straight. Because if it were my preference, this guy, he's one of my personal heroes because of what he went through to get his people safe, even though he sacrificed his life to do it. So, the ancestors, okay, here we are. Ay, ay, ay. No gracias. No gracias. Yeah, yeah. Okay, to make our little homeland area here in New Mexico part of the Central Arizona Project, ay, ay, ay. No gracias. Enough said, right? So let's take a step back in time and look at a couple of other really interesting interbasin stories where people coming in have figured out ways of letting wet areas benefit dry areas, sustainable ways, culturally sustainable ways. And if we look back into our history, maybe we can learn something. This first example, I call it La Sequía de Juan del Oso. The real name of it is La Sequía del Rito Griego y la Sierra in the Upper Mora Valley. And this one is called La Sequía del Nacimiento, but it's I like to call it the San Gregorio Sequía because it originates in San Gregorio Lake. So what's going on with these folks? Let's start up in Mora. There's a problem in Mora. Here's the Rio Grande watershed going. All of the water in this area goes off this way and down into the canyons of the Rio Grande. What ends up going this way, it's forested, there's rain and everything, but all of these valleys were pretty much dry sage flats, and then you get a little riparian band right next to the river. And so what happened when the Comanche Wars ended? Over here in Picuris, where everybody was holed up behind 3-foot adobe walls, when the Comanche problem was negotiated and solved, everybody came over the top and started looking to farm, but they could see how dry it was. And by the 1830s, they started exploring ways of taking little threads of water from one watershed into another. And this part here is actually a 1,000-foot waterfall that takes water from the Rio Grande into the Mississippi, if whatever drops make it past the Mora Valley. So it's really a prodigious, you know, seventh wonder of New Mexico that very few people know about. This is what it looks like going over the top, and then these valleys of Mora, they're beautiful, but I call them culturally green because they are not naturally green. Naturally speaking, they would be sage and arid and maybe pasture. Naturally speaking, they would be sage and arid and maybe pasture. And so let's go back into oral tradition. The people talk about asking permission of the elders of Picuris to do these little diversions. And on the Picuris side, as well as the Mora side, they got that permission. And so they went ahead and did it. But we decided I've got an academic paper on all of this for anyone who would care to read it. But we also put it in the form of a children's book, and we combined it with the story of the guy whose dad is the bear, John the Bear. We have all these Johns and Jacks in our oral tradition, in our folklore, and it's the same. It's European folklore, and so in English they're los Juanes, and in Spanish folklore, in English folklore, it's It's John or Jack, of course. And that's before Superman, before Spider-Man, before all these guys. And so we put the story together. And these are characters from the story. This guy's name, we didn't make this up. This guy's name is Mudarrios. He's the river mover. It's such a deep, deep thing, mythically, and so deep into the psyche. It's so appealing to human beings that, yeah, wow, we wanna do it, except it gets out of hand with technology, right? He flooded his village, and so they kicked him out. He had to go up to the mountains to live. And there's his friend, Mudarrios. He's the hill mover. If he sees a hill, he wants to move it somewhere else. And so these guys are characters in these stories. And so he got in trouble because he caused a landslide that almost killed his uncle. And they said, you can't live in our village anymore. You have to go up in the mountains. And of course, that's where the bear's son ends up. They kick him out because he's so strong. He grew up in 3 months. He's so strong that he started hurting people. He didn't know his own strength. So he got to go up to the mountains, and he met his dad, and his dad still loved his mom. His mom's a human being. And he said, I've got a plan. We're going to bring water to the Mora Valley. So that's what they do. And this is it. This is it. This is what it looked like. They hadn't been able to do anything to it since the 1950s. Now there's a nice new dam here with a fish trap so that the cutthroats stay above and the rainbows stay below. But it took so much. I mean, they really are grandfathered in, although they're still fighting the legal battles. Like Picuris is all lawyered up, and they could have it all. And except the people in Mora, they've got so much Picuris blood that in the generation of the grandparents, they were going to St. Kate's Indian School. They had so much Picuris blood. So now the lawyers are going to take their water away? I don't know. Here it is. This is it. This is the Acequia del Rito Griego. It's a 1,000-foot waterfall. And here it is, making the valleys green and making Mora the most productive agricultural county in New Mexico, because it was servicing Fort Union back in the day. So here's another example of these kinds of things, but maybe examples we can learn from their cultural sustainability. This one didn't start off with consulting the local pueblo, but it ended up consulting with it, and it's still a viable operation. And you can see, here's Cuba, New Mexico. You can see the aridity of this side of the mountain. And on this side of the mountain, it's the Jemez watershed. And they found a little cienega over here in the 1880s when things calmed down with the Navajos. And because Cuba is also a border town to the Navajo reservation. And they figured out a way to take a wetlands and block it off a little bit and take a little stream of water over here. I'm talking about, you know, 3-4 cubic feet per second. These are tiny flows, but over on this side, it's 716 acres. So I like to call it La Sequía de San Gregorio. There's some great history here. Of course, it's a great fishing lake now. They lease it to the Game and Fish. It's the San Pedro Parks Wilderness. But these people were there before the forest. They were there before the wilderness. And so now, well, what happens? Jemez got all lawyered up, Jemez Pueblo. And then before reaching the settlement, the lawyers said, you could have it all. You could have it all. And they took it out of court, and they did the ancient practice of the repartimiento, the dividing, the sharing of the waters, the sharing of the drought. And they said, okay, if things get rough, all of our Hispano neighbors, including way up at the headwaters, they will get 3 days a week, and we'll take the 4 days a week since we were here first. And it's just totally enlightened. I mean, it's the wisdom of the elders in play. And they had to stop the court proceeding. They said, stop it right now. The lawyers go out. Special master, we're going to work this out. And they worked it out in a culturally sustainable way. Great story. So it has some other stories here. Since it's wilderness, you know, here's the water going through a little cork bark fir forest. Every year, the trees fall down. And of course, with wilderness, there's no machines. Back in the 1980s, they needed to repair the dam. It's 30 acres of water storage up there. It's a significant piece of work. But they had to take 40 tons of rock up to fix the dam. And with the wilderness, which is administered by the Floresta, the Forest Service, whose employees are people from the local town, you know, and they said, oh my God, you know, you can't use machines. They said, yeah, we know. Just let us use wheelbarrows to take up 40,000 tons of rock to fix our dam. And they said, no, you can't do it. The wheelbarrow is a machine. And so they used mules to cart up 40,000 tons of rock to fix their dam. This is a kind of heroism. This is Iron John. This is Iron Jack. This is the bear's son. This is the determination that it takes to see these things through. And finally, some guy, one of the acequeros in the Nacimiento Acequia, when he was in high school in Cuba in 1967, he got one of those newfangled cassette machines. He interviewed his grandfather, and his grandfather said, oh, yeah, we used to take our Model T trucks. We'd back them up the Bordo. The Bordo is the banks of the Acequia, which is also an easement. It's an ancient easement system. And they said when we needed to work on the dam, we took our Model Ts up there. And so it was like Eureka. It was a Eureka moment. Here's the tribute to the kind of work that we love to do, that Jack especially. You know, these voices are available to future people. So they said, okay, now you can use your chainsaws. You don't have to get up there with your little hatchets, you know, cutting down, removing all these trees from your acequia. So it's another heroic story. So I thought I'd just distract you from the giant problem at hand and declare my solidarity with you. You guys are my heroes. There's a whole line of folks here since 1984 to now, and these things are ongoing. So thank you so much for your work, and El Rio Gila para siempre libre, digo yo. And the Gila, you know, I've read a bunch of etymologies about where does that word come from, but my Navajo friends say that it's from the Navajo word for mountain, and it must be closely connected to the Apache word for mountain. The word for Mount Taylor. Zachary Taylor, forget him. The word for Mount Taylor is Tzotzil, and it's Turquoise Boy Mountain. It's San Mateo Mountain in Spanish, one of the four pillars of heaven. And so that's my theory on Gila, according to my Navajo friends. They say Tzilt. Tzilt is, in Spanish, we can't say that, so we say Gila. So maybe that's where it all comes from, but siempre libre, que viva el río Gila, y gracias.
Enrique knows an awful lot of stuff. He told me not to tell you that he has recently retired from the chair of the Portuguese-Spanish department at UNM. He also knows about everything there is to know about acequias in Nuevo Mexico. He's really a very knowledgeable person, and actually he put together this book from whence you saw the artwork for this. Juan the Bear and the Water of Life, La Sequía de Juan del Oso. Enrique Lamadrid y Juan Esteban Arellano, our fallen comrade. Well, at this point, Joe, I'm going to ask you to put up Rena's picture, if you would. Rena couldn't be here in person, But she is with us here in spirit, believe me. Rena Swensel, I'll talk a little bit about Rena. She was born in the Santa Clara Pueblo, which is one of the Tewa-speaking pueblos in the northern Rio Grande. And she's one of the wisest fellow humans I've ever met in my life. And she was looking forward so much to be here this evening because she wanted to share some of that Puebloan perspective with you. As Enrique said at the beginning of his part, it's wonderful to bring in the ancestors. And so what I'm going to do, being the oral historian that Enrique says I am, I'm going to play you three brief pieces of Rena Swensel talking about various aspects of her own perspective. I recorded these at different times, and so you might hear a slight difference in sound quality, but here is our old pal, Rena Swensel.
The way the old Pueblo people were trying to make sense of what was around them, you know, here, especially in the Southwest, you look around you and you see that horizon, 360-degree horizon around you. And then you see that blue with the clouds going over it, over you. And the sense they made of it was the center. You are the center. At any point that you stand in the Southwest, you are the center and you are in containment. At any point that you stand in, you as the center. And the Pueblo people really picked up on that and said, look, we live within the earth bowl. This is where we dwell. Wherever we are at the center. Which is literally true. I mean, that's what we experience every day. We experience this in a very central way every day. And being at the center, seeing that far horizon with the mountains that contain us in this earth bowl, and all the, you know, the symbolic kiva bowls that the Pueblo people make with the mountains along the rim of it, it is all about that. And then the earth is covered by the sky basket. And you're talking about the marriage between earth and sky. That's exactly what they were talking about, the father and the mother. But it was not in terms so much as of male and female as it was father and mother, which is a very different concept. Male and female then become included within father and mother. And that is a very different meaning than saying the male sky and the female earth, which brings in explicit kind of sexuality, which the Pueblo people weren't so much interested in as in the parental nature of mother and father within which creation happens, because it's only when the male and female come together as father and mother and children are produced that creation really happens. This is the creation right now because those two have come around us. In that sense, then, Pueblo people talk about a community as having mothers and fathers and children. And, you know, the oldest people are always talked about as father. And then their mothers in those communities also. Many, whether they're your mothers or not, whether they're your fathers, they're known as. But then everybody else is children. But those people are also children. But the flexibility of roles in that way. But the notion of having people who are responsible and nurturing and caring about the entire context that one lives in. It's that kind of model that was taken from the way they saw the cosmos as being structured, the way the cosmos is ordered. It is within that context that we live here. Trees are living beings. Rocks are living beings. The spirit moves through the water. An incredible word that we have for the source of life is something we talk about as the Bo-wan-han, the water, wind, breath. It is there in the water and in the wind that we can see the spirit, that we can see life moving. It's there where the life force is visible, as well as in the clouds, of course. We don't take the life force and put it in a superhuman being as Christians do with God. that already begins to show us the focus on human beings. When you put the life force in a superhuman creature, we keep it within the trees, within the water, within the wind, within the clouds. And we are to move through that context of the water, the wind, and breathe the same breath that we are breathing, the same breath that the rocks do, that the wind does. That gives you a totally different feeling. This is it. There's no other reality. We don't go to heaven. We don't leave this dirty world to go to a golden, clean heaven. We are here. This is it. This is the world. It doesn't get any better than this. And if we don't honor it in the sense that this is the best, as beautiful as it's ever going to be, then we can't take care of it if we think that it's a place to be shunned and that we have better things to look forward to. Then we can't walk respectfully where we are at this moment and take care of things and touch things with honor and breathe each breath. That's what that water wind breath is about. It's, my goodness, here it is, and every second I can breathe it in and I become a part of this world. In no uncertain terms, I am a part of this world that I live in every second because I breathe it every second. What I've been thinking about a lot with community is that we've gotten too small a definition of community. And I go back to Pueblo thinking because their community really was not just the human community. It included the place within which we lived, so that the mountains were part of community. The water was part of community. Trees, rocks, plants. You couldn't move through any day in that old world, even when I was growing up, without knowing that you were part of that whole community of trees, rocks, people. Today, what we do is really just talk about human community, and it gets to be such a small thing within the larger scope of things. We keep making the world smaller and smaller until it's nothing but us. It's just human beings, out of context, out of our natural context, out of our cosmological context. We have become so small in our view of the world. Our world is simply us human beings. That's a crucial thing that we need to get beyond and move back again to seeing ourselves within context. From a Pueblo point of view, the commons is everything. It is the context that we live in. The community was always thought of as being a whole. Everything was interconnected. There was always a center to it as well. And I was a center, you were a center. There were many centers as a part of the whole thing. With the Pueblo, there are so many simultaneous things that can happen at once, which is all part of the commons, I think. There are so many things that go on at the same time. The wind is blowing, the water's flowing, and we're actually walking around and talking, and it's all part of what we all share. In that Pueblo context, then, the focus was always, what is it that surrounds me all the time? But the primary thing is that we felt that it was the earth, the sky, the clouds, the wind, and that incredible term that we have, for me, says it all. It's the bo wang, huh? The water, wind, breath. That connects, it moves through our entire world in such a way that it connects everybody and everything. That becomes the commons. In the Pueblo, it really was that thing that swirls around, that blows, that moves, that creates that sense of commons. It's the ultimate of what is common to every living being. The trees, with the rocks, with all of that, that makes our life what it is today.
Rena Swensel is really something. And she wanted so much to be here this evening, and so this is as close as we could get. But Rena talking about the commons, that says it all. At least a lot of the spiritual aspect of it, it certainly does. And now I would like to introduce another buddy, Brother Steve Harris. He's the owner-operator of Far-Flung Adventures, and he's been the head of the Rio Grande Restoration for a long time. And there are not many folks around who know more about flowing water in New Mexico than Steve Harris. So go for it, Steve.
Because I'm only allotted 10 minutes, I have prepared some remarks and printed them. And I hope you'll forgive me if it doesn't sound quite so conversational. Hopefully it's the heart behind it will come through. Thanks a lot, Jack. This is a great honor to appear with you again. I'm really in awe of the work that you've done over all these years. Defining the hydro commons, it's what connects all of us, especially in dry places like the Southwest. And Rena really nailed it, didn't she, when she said that this is it. I think was her exact words, this is it. Here's another question. Who can tell me where we are, Todd? This is the spillway at San Carlos Reservoir. And in case I forget to make this point another time, and in case this has escaped anyone out there, the Gila River is not a free-flowing river. The opponents or the proponents of the project are right. This is not a free-flowing river. It is one of the poster children for complete desiccation and desecration of rivers in the American Southwest. San Carlos Reservoir begins the process, and the final coup is some 100 miles upstream of its original destiny to reach the Colorado River, which in itself is so completely overused as to not make its original destiny in the Gulf of California. This is Arizona, yeah. This is, the Gila dies once at Safford during the irrigation season. The return flows flow into San Carlos Reservoir and get doled out once again in the middle Gila Valley. And then it dies again. I'm forgetting the name of the reservoir. There are so many of them, and they all look alike. In any case, we know that there's a few sections of river left in the United States that mostly in the headwaters, mostly watershed-driven, mostly in places like Silver City where time forgot, except for the mining companies. Out-of-the-way places where we had bigger projects to build as Americans, and we didn't quite get around to finishing things like Hooker Dam or damming the Yampa River, which is very much on the drawing boards now, or the little bitty Smith River, the only coastal range river that's free-flowing in the state of California. There's just a handful of such rivers. And I'm going to make the point that we're about to reach the end of the federal dam building era. Show of hands, who believes me? All right, I like you optimistic, hopeful people. Let's say hope. We'll keep hope alive. So basically, in order to do a TED talk in the next 3 minutes on the history of water development in the American West, we have five, actually now we're in the sixth separate phase. The first phase is, I call the big barbecue. I borrowed the term from Charles Wilkinson, a Western historian and author of the book, Reclaiming the Headwaters. And this is the period of time when we pretty much turned all the natural resources we could into dollars. Some of the biggest corporations in America were involved in this. And it was in order to secure the entirety of the 17 Western states as an energy, forestry, grazing colony to the American Empire. And then a miracle happened in the 1890 to 1929 period, kind of under the leadership of Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy's the symbolic icon of this particular period of water development. We decided that this you know, this was unsustainable. The word wasn't out there, of course, but it couldn't go on like this. You know, the pastures were bare, and progressive conservation was born. And ironically, out of progressive conservation then, in 1902, the Federal Reclamation Act turned federal bureaucracies and a lot of federal money loose on the rivers of the West. The New Deal, centralized development, this was sort of, a lot of people accused Franklin Roosevelt of being a socialist and somehow using these centralized make-work projects got us out of the Great Depression, aided, of course, by the expedient of going to war. And then I want to particularly focus on the period after 1946 here, the big dam era. This is the grand finale. This is when we got McPhee Reservoir, we got Glen Canyon Dam, we got the Central Arizona Project, we got the Animas La Plata Project, we got the final coup on a lot of tributaries of Western rivers. And then with Earth Day in 1970 and the whole panoply of environmental regulations that we enjoy now, the age of environmentalism. Throughout all of this, water development has proceeded at some kind of clip. And I want to point out some of the events, the more recent events and the current events that make me think that we may finally get over this. An example of the big barbecue. This is 400 million railroad ties sitting in the mouth of the Rio Embudo in the Rio Grande Basin. And this is not an atypical scene. Clear cutting was the way that we handled forestry in those days. I want to point out that we're still struggling with the policies that came from that big barbecue period of time. We see it in some of the streams in southwestern New Mexico, but particularly in the San Juan Mountains, where nearly every river has a rim of acid, precipitate, discoloration, often rusty, often puke yellow, that is an ongoing legacy of the period where the 1872 mining law permitted any comer, didn't even have to be an American citizen, to go and file on a mineral claim, and if you could gouge the minerals out of the ground, you could have it. And as we all saw back in August, one of those mines, when we dug into the water table, released 300 million gallons of heavy metals into the Animas River, thence into the San Juan River. And the 1872 mining law, despite several challenges over time, is still the law of the land. So these things, these tendencies of the Anglo-American conquerors to maintain the resource exploitation economy is it's intense. It's persistent. This is from the early reclamation era. It's a typical reclamation dam. We built a lot of these. There were probably 600 of these built by 1946 by the Bureau of Reclamation. Every state in the Union got one of these dams or more, and they were designed to promote the development of irrigated agriculture. Farmers organized into irrigation districts to pay the Bureau back. The cost of building a structure like this, which was substantial. This is kind of the engineering paradigm of irrigated agriculture there. And the way that this worked was we spread the wealth around. We pretended that the farmers were going to be able to pay us back, but these were really gifts. These were really subsidies from the federal government. And the way it worked was the local boosters were the face of the project. They were the beneficiaries. They were the ones who wanted it. They were passionate. They were sincere. They elected U.S. representatives who wanted to bring home the bacon. That's how they maintained re-elections. And, of course, the Bureau of Reclamation was a gang of 30,000 engineers that wanted to build dams. This is kind of, Jeffrey would like this one. This is the concrete cooling in Hoover Dam. This is the core of Hoover Dam, which was truly a great feat of engineering. And things like the Hoover Dam and the Grand Coulee Dam and Shasta Dam actually paid for the repayment of irrigation contracts that the the farmers couldn't pay back, even after Congress granted them 20, then 30, then 40 years to repay and cut their interest payments to zero. It took some bright engineer to come up with hydroelectric power, the cash register dam, in order to make this whole proposition financially feasible. Before that, before the Great Depression and the New Deal, reclamation was in big trouble. It was about to default on a lot of this stuff, and Congress wasn't quite so appealing to spend money on failed projects as it was to bring home the bacon to your constituents. So I said I wanted to concentrate on the period after 1946, but this is a TED Talk, so I'm going to hurry on along through this. I found a book on Amazon, which I don't ordinarily like to go online. I'd rather shop with Dennis and my local booksellers in Taos County where I live. And the book was entitled Colorado River, Total Use for Greater Wealth. And the book was a large folio book. It was printed in sufficient quantities that every member of Congress received one. And one of the features of this, there were some neat maps, some wonderful photos, some history of all the dams that had been built prior to 1946. But there was page after page after page in six-point agate type of projects that the Bureau wanted to build, that they'd already identified as being the next water projects that they wanted to build. So think about this. Let's have a moment of silence to think about total use and greater wealth. Also in 1946, a man named Bernard DeVoto was writing in Harper's Magazine about Western resource exploitation and what was going on even then, you know, in furtherance of all of this wealth taking. And Donald Worster, in a book called Rivers of Empire, described DeVoto's dilemma that was going on. I want to read you from that. In Rivers of Empire, he talks about 1946. So while Bernard DeVoto worried mainly what Western stockmen, lumber companies, and other public land raiders were fixing to do to the West, what he did not mention was what the water hustlers out there were lining up to do. In the next two decades or so, they would lay their hands on virtually every river and tributary in the region, obliterating entire watersheds in a rage for comprehensive multi-purpose water development. They would insist with sincere, breathless urgency and a frantic, intense will to believe, in which was mixed the crassest self-interest and patriotic promotion, that without more water, death itself was stalking the land. Their anxious need to get more water, to expand their manipulation of nature, was so intense it became a kind of totalitarian impulse, a drive to capture and hold on to every single drop that fell on the West. And in their anxiety, most of it self-induced and contrived, in their unquenchable quest for control, they would make their final push to empire. Okay, so that's sort of the prelude of what comes next in this little historical narrative. Ah, yes. So in the next 30 years, the golden age of dam building came complete with a pantheon of demigods. Gruff old Floyd Dominey ran the Bureau for much of this era and made Glen Canyon Dam a personal mission. Wayne Aspinall presided over the House Interior Committee for most of these 30 years. And that's the committee that could and did send piles of dam building legislation to a floor vote. He was from southwestern Colorado. And it's no accident that in 1956, a lot of the bills, the 25 dams authorized by the Colorado River Basin Project Act, four of them were in southwestern Colorado. Animas La Plata, a useless dam project if ever there was one. McPhee Reservoir, which turned dryland bean farmers into irrigating bean farmers, and, of course, our friend Glen Canyon Dam. These are just the high points of the list of dam-killing legislation during that period of time. Central Utah Project, Central Arizona Project. Our own Hooker Dam was authorized in the Colorado River Basin Project Act of 1968, which guaranteed us the right, we, New Mexico, to divert a new 18,000 acre feet of Gila River water. And then something else amazing happened, and I liken this to what happened in the 1890 to 1900 period. Conditions were such that we had a little epiphany as a nation. If you believe in the national imagination, the public imagination, something changed. Briefly, we elected Jimmy Carter, and Jimmy Carter bravely, and I'm proud that Jimmy Carter was a river runner, tried to put a rational basis on the selection of reservoir projects, not just the phony baloney benefit-cost ratios that the Bureau had been and the Corps had been using all along, but something real. And he proposed that 30 of these authorized dam projects go down, become deauthorized. In the end, he spent an immense amount of political capital getting rid of 9 of these projects, but that's 9 river-saving projects that happened during the Carter years. And this was after the nation had caught the environmental spirit. This was after Congress had passed the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Wilderness Act, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. There's more. All of these things in about a 5-year period during the Nixon administration. Another surprising fact in light of what we're seeing today in partisan politics is that when Ronald Reagan came into office on a platform of fiscal responsibility, he eliminated what had been a possible 100% subsidy for folks that wanted to build a dam. The local boosters, the local beneficiaries, could heretofore have gotten all of the money provided to them by the federal government. Reagan said, no, you're going to have to show that you want, not only do these projects now have to be shown to be feasible, to be economically beneficial, you're going to have to put your money where your mouth is, fold up your hand and put it back in your pocket. So I wanted to turn all David Letterman now that the TED Talk's over. Did I make my 3 minutes? Oh, whoops. That was 5 TED Talks. My top 10 reasons for optimism that we are finally witnessing the end of the federal dam building era. As rivers vanish, their value increases. This is basic Adam Smith economics. They're scarce, so they're valuable. Plus, I think Rena pointed to something that doesn't get into the argument in the Gila, and that is that these rivers are tremendously important to us in our hearts, in our genes, in our being. If everything is straight lines and engineered, we lose something very, very important in our lives. So that's number 10. Number 9, all the good sites are built out. That's really pretty true. Hooker Dam would have worked, right, Norm? But we couldn't get it built. What they're proposing now is folly. Number 8, tourism and amenity economies have overtaken resource exploitation in the West, and visitors need a few wild rivers. Modern benefit-cost analysis have expanded the focus of such studies to include values of externalities, who is getting hurt and not getting compensated, biodiversity, who's going extinct, and recreation, boaters, fishers, hunters. Number 7, Commissioner of Reclamation Mike Connor, citing the growing importance of species protection, noted that the Bureau of Reclamation has 17 recovery programs it's participating in and funding, and in some cases leading, suggested renaming the Bureau of Restoration. Number 5, dams are coming down. See the Elwha. I wish I could have captured the 5-minute picture time-lapse photo of the Elwha Dam being dismantled. And there are others. These things silt up. The powers that they're producing is negligible. They're ugly, they kill fish, and we don't need them. The dams are coming down already. Number four, minute 319. Show of hands, who knows what minute 319 is? Minute 319 was an agreement among water users in Mexico and the United States, all of the state engineers of the West, that we could release water out of Hoover Reservoir last year, and think about the bathtub ring, and in order to water the Colorado River once again all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Reason number three. We're in an age of federal fiscal austerity, and Congress is reluctant to do earmarks. Joe, congressman in Illinois, doesn't want to take money away from his project to pay for projects in the Southwest. Number two, despite the vaunted drought we hear so much about, Las Vegas has offered to lease water to Southern California. This in a blog from John Fleck just last week. Something phony about all the tub thumping about drought. Couldn't we just like all conserve or something? And number one, and I'm echoing Enrique on this one, the anti-dam activism of the Silver City community. So to close it up, I think if we can succeed in squelching the Gila River Diversion Project in the next year or so, this community can gain the wherewithal to finance conservation, efficiency, and watershed restoration projects, and thereby demonstrate to the rest of New Mexico our most hopeful path as a state to water security. And I think it's got great potential, if we can make this happen in the next year or so, of halting the destruction of the remaining fully living rivers in the western United States, and truly usher in the era of restoration.